There was a show when I was a kid called The Chuckle Hounds, and I think it was a spin-off of The Chuckle Brothers, which was two men doing physical comedy and nonsense and assorting, expecting a Laurel and Hardy movie, except it was for children in the 1980s. It was actually quite good. But then there was another thing called The Chuckle Hounds that would be on sometimes. I don't know if it was related or it was the same two men. It was two people in dog suits doing very Chuckle Brothers type stuff. I've never looked into that. Was The Chuckle Hounds related to The Chuckle Brothers? I know The Chuckle Brothers had two other brothers who themselves formed a duo and they would do other stuff. But I don't know if The Hounds was any relation to any of them. And one of The Chuckle Brothers is dead. So does that mean one of the Chuckle Hounds is dead? I don't know. No way of, well, there's probably some way of knowing. I could look it up. I don't look up stuff while I'm talking, though. We don't do that anymore. That never goes well. It serves as a distraction. I have to take out my phone and hold it up to my face and start typing stuff on a screen on a fake pop-up virtual keyboard. I go, are the Chuckle Hounds the same as the Chuckle Brothers? Search. Obviously, they're a different species. Well, they're portraying a different species. Well, you have to presume there's humans involved in there somewhere. They're not actual hounds. Is a hound a dog? I'm not sure. I get confused about those things because it's like with the badminton tennis thing or the hare bunny rabbit thing. Are hares and bunnies types of rabbit? Are they a different thing? Is badminton like tennis? I know badminton is a different sport to tennis. Oh, it's kind of comparable. Badminton and tennis are kind of comparable. I suppose badminton, that's the one that doesn't use a ball, it used a shuttlecock. A shuttlecock is kind of like a ball, except it's more like a cupcake container. If you're making an individual mini tiny bun, you'd make it in a kind of wrapping thing. You'd put it into one of those and then you put 12 of them in the oven. Or if you're a baker, you put 13, which is very inefficient. If you're a baker and you're making baker's dozens or something, like a small bun, you're making 12 of them, but you're making an extra one. That's inefficient, and I don't mind explaining why. Because when you're cooking buns, you get a tray, and it's got holes cut into it, an even number of holes. There's not going to be one with 13, because it's four rows across and three rows down. They're not going to have a separate little extra one on the side. That's very inefficient. It's a waste of cooker space. You'll end up with a non-rectangular baking tray. You put 13 buns in it. So where's the four rows across and three rows down, but then there's an extra one. So you have an L-shaped tray. That's really inefficient. You're using an industrial oven. You want to use every inch of that oven shelf. Unless, I suppose, you have more than one of these baking trays and they're made to fit around each other like Tetris pieces. I suppose there's that. Bakers are professional. They know what they're doing. They can do it in their sleep. In fact, they do. That's why you hear about bakers being up at 5 in the morning. That's when they do all their baking. They're all asleep. They're so good at it. They can do it in their sleep. And they want to prove that by doing it in their sleep. They set an alarm for 2 a.m. So they kind of half wake up. But then they drift off back to sleep in their car on the way to the bakery. And then they do everything in their sleep. It's very efficient. You wake up just enough to get yourself into the car and get going. And then, as we all know, with driving, if you've been driving all your life, you're doing that practically subconsciously. You're on automatic when you're driving. A car doesn't have to be on automatic. It can be a gear shift mechanism car, but you can be driving on autopilot. It's nothing to do with the makeup of the car. No, you're doing this subconsciously. And while you're doing that, you're thinking about all your Tetris pieces and how they're going to fit together in the oven and not waste a single inch of that oven shelf space. Even though there's an odd number of cups on that baking tray. Anyway, these Huckleberry Hound people, the hounds are like Disney characters. It's someone dressed as a cartoon animal. Wait, would you call that a cartoon animal? The Huckleberry Hounds wasn't a cartoon. There was a live-action thing. It was people in suits. You don't call that a cartoon, do you? But you don't call that a puppet either, no. You call it people in rig-outs, dressed to look like hounds, dressed to convince children that they're hounds. I suspect that was the Chuckle Brothers inside those suits. which is rather stupid. They were perfectly fine as themselves, or as their on-screen human personas. They were perfectly fine. There was no need to go to all that trouble of turning themselves into another species to do exactly the same thing. No. Ever have an opportunity to undergo plastic surgery? Perhaps you've been in a massive road accident and thankfully you've survived. Just the outside of your body hasn't survived intact. You have some dents and you have some issues, you have some outstanding items, injuries from your car crash, keeping you needing to go back to the doctor for more and more treatment. You go to some plastic surgeon and you say, hello, I'm not made out of plastic, but I'm hoping you'll do some work on me, on my non-plastic corporeal physical being, so that the rest of me that's inside here can continue to survive inside this shell of a body. It's barely ticking over. My brain is working, as you can see, or as you can hear, because I'm able to form sentences. I've even got a podcast. Tell them you've got a podcast, but you have to convince this plastic surgeon that there's something in there worth saving. Because they're looking at your face and they're thinking, oh, Christ, no, he's finished. He's done. There's no more of him. He might as well just walk over there and die now. You might as well do what some tribal communities, the elderly will just walk out into the desert or the jungle when they're ready to die and just not come back and decides not to be a burden. He might as well do that, your plastic surgeon is thinking. So you have to prove to your plastic surgeon that there's a person still in there, being behind that non-face, underneath that scalp that's turned to mush. You have to prove that the stuff that's inside your brain is not turned to mush, which is quite difficult because, for one thing, a normal brain is composed of mush. It's just grey mush. It looks like, even a healthy brain, it looks like porridge. If you were to take out your brain and show it to someone today, they'd say, oh my God, what's that? Is that overnight oats? I've heard of those. I find those very off-putting. You made them the night before. So the first thing that happens when you sit down to eat them for your breakfast is that you realize they're already at least 12 hours old. Can you imagine if you went into a McDonald's and they gave you fries and burgers that were 12 hours old, that had been cooked 12 hours ago? Or they tell you, oh no, it's okay, these fries have been slow cooked overnight, so they're fresh. You wouldn't accept that. Or maybe you would because you're meek. That's why you're going to a McDonald's. If you were less meek, you'd treat yourself to something more worthy of you. You'd go to a fancy restaurant. Well, no, you've chosen to go to McDonald's despite being very, very, very rich because you're meek. Let's not go into that billionaire fella again, Warren, what's his name? Because I already covered him in two episodes in the past year, Warren Buffet and his McDonald's drive-thru breakfast that he punishes himself with. No, you won't go into that again. Suffice to say, you have to convince this plastic surgeon that there's still something alive in there. And I suppose you're making a good job of that just by speaking. You just try to sound non-automated. Try to sound like you're not controlled by some artificial intelligence. Or maybe that would be the way to go. Maybe you should convince him that you are artificial intelligence, that you're an android whose outer coating was experimental and made of human flesh and has not really survived the crash, but can you help him because you're one of the most miraculous inventions ever made despite what you look like on the outside? Maybe that'll work. Then of course the problem will be that their plastic surgeon will say, oh, unfortunately I'm not qualified to work on robots and machinery. I'm not an engineer, I'm not a mechanic, I'm not some sort of computer maker or computer repairer. No, I'm a doctor. I have a doctorate in medical doctorology. I'm not like Dr. Phil or Dr. Dre or one of them. No, I'm a doctor of medical stuff. I'm called a plastic surgeon, but I'm not made of plastic and I don't work with I do work with plastic. Wait, do I? Do plastic surgeons work with actual plastic? Or is that just a thing they're called? they use non-organic materials to repair you sometimes. But is it plastic? Maybe it is. I don't know. Well, I suppose heart surgeons use bits of metal and bits of plastic to replace bits of you that are broken. So why not? I suppose if you break bones sometimes, they use a couple of screws and a bit of metal, a metal plate or something. So I suppose it's perfectly legitimate for a plastic surgeon to use bits of plastic, or maybe does he get liquid plastic and form it into a mold after he puts it inside you? Maybe they can do that. Can you do keyhole surgery now where you pour the liquid plastic into a vein somewhere through a needle and then have it so it cools down just when it gets to the area that you want to fill? Maybe so. Maybe so. I don't know. So nice to say, don't worry about that. Don't worry about your plastic surgeon, what he does. Your job is to convince him that you're worth saving. So say something worth saying. Tell him you've learned the third secret of Fatima and you're going to reveal it as long as he fixes you. And offer him a bribe. Tell him, I hereby offer you a bribe to fix me. And the plastic surgeon, of course, will say, sure, I'm literally a commercial plastic surgeon. I will be invoicing you at the end of this. So offering me money does not add anything to it. You're going to be giving me money anyway. In fact, I'm going to need to see your credit card now, because it sounds like you thought you weren't going to have to pay, but you are going to have to pay me. So I'll have a deposit, please. Give me your credit card and I'll take some money off that. I'll isolate some money in your account and then we'll keep that aside for when I actually have something to bill you for. Because I'm not going through all that again where I do all this work on someone and then I find out they don't want to pay me. I'll say, please pay me. And they'll say, no, I don't want you to pay you. And then I'll say again, no, please pay me. Also, you must pay me. This is your bill. And they say, I don't have any money to pay you with. And you'll say, well, why didn't you tell me you hadn't got any money to pay with? And invariably they say, you didn't ask me whether I have any money to pay you with. I thought your employer would pay you. I'm not your employer. I'm not your human resources department. I'm not your wages department. I know the wages department is probably a separate thing from your human resources department. One looks after personnel issues, the other issues the checks, does the payroll. But no, I don't have any money to pay you. And the surgeon, of course, will remember this for a long time. And that's why you have to convince him you're worth saving in more ways than one. You have to show him your bank account. Show him your bank account. Say, here's my bank account. I don't mean show a statement showing what's in your bank account. If you want to impress him, make sure you're using a branch of your bank that's in the city centre. That's one of those old ornate branches that they built in the 1920s or something. They used to build these banks and train stations that look like cathedrals. So you'd have great trust in this bank. They were rock solid. So show them a photo of your bank. Maybe that one in College Green in Dublin, that very fancy looking bank. That used to be the Houses of Parliament for this country. Now, what else? Oh yeah, then show him, well, don't show him the inside of your brain, literally. But demonstrate to him that you have a mind, you have an active mind. Do a crossword in front of him. Get out the Irish Times crossword. Make sure you get today's one. If you do yesterday's, he's going to say, oh, he's been practicing that all night. He probably got 3 copies of the same newspaper, or he used a pencil and a razor. He's practiced that. No, get good at doing the Irish Times crossword and then do it in half a minute right in front of him while downing a pint of vodka or something impressive like that. Whatever you think will impress this fella. You should probably get to know the plastic surgeon as well, so you have an idea as to what will or won't impress him. If you find out that he does a lot of crosswords and is better at them than you, then that won't impress him. No, make sure he knows nothing about crosswords. In fact, do a crossword in front of him. He'll say, oh, I've never done one of them. That's really good. I've tried doing one of them last time I did it, and half of my letters disappeared in the blank. There's these black squares, and when you write in them, you can't see what you've written. It gets very confusing. You can't even see your own work. It's very impressive that he's just writing all the words in. It looks like they're correct. It looks like they're real words. He's not writing in the black squares. I wonder why that is. Wait, are you cheating? You're not writing anything in the black squares on that crossword. They did that in chess. Half of the squares in chess are one color and half of the squares are another color. Sometimes it's black and white. Sometimes it's brown and light brown. It depends on the design of the chessboard. I had the chessboard where I think the dark squares were dark brown and the light squares were sort of creamy yellow magnolia. But in a crossword, invariably, you have black squares and white squares, not necessarily 50-50 on the crossword, the way it is on a draughts board or a chess board. No. You're not supposed to write in the black bits anyway, but the plastic surgeon doesn't know that. So he might think you're cheating. So write in some of the black squares anyway. Use a black biro so you can't see what you're writing in the black squares. We won't be able to see it anyway, but that's okay because you just be putting nonsense in there. It's fine. So that's how you deal with your plastic surgeon. Anyway, best of luck with that. I hope you get your face back or whatever else you're missing. What are you missing? Maybe it's some other part of your body. Maybe it's the covering on your knees. Your knees themselves are fine. They're working very well. You ran a 4-mile walk this morning. You got up out of bed, you opened the door, and then you went outside the door, and then you closed the door, and you walked out to the pavement, and you walked a mile, and it took you 4 minutes. 4 minutes, which is great. A 4-minute mile is very impressive, although you're not the first person to do it. You do realize that. The 4-minute mile record was broken many years ago. And the first time someone did the 4-minute mile, within weeks of that, everyone else was doing it. Suddenly, it was just not impressive anymore. Nobody was impressed by the 4-minute mile. But if you're doing a 4-minute mile whereby you count it from when you get out of bed, you get out of bed and you set your stopwatch then, so the 4 minutes, that includes the 30 seconds of getting dressed, getting down the stairs, getting out to your front door, opening the door, closing it, locking the door, going out to the curb and then going back to your door to make sure you locked it, then going out to the curb again and then walking a mile. And you do all that within the 4 minutes, then that's impressive. Should probably rebrand it, called it the 3.5-minute mile. As no one's going to notice how impressive it is if you just keep calling it the 4-minute mile. You're getting more done within the 4 minutes. No, they won't know that. Branding is important. I know you feel dirty using things like branding and marketing for something as natural as pushing the human body to its limits and looking after your health and fitness. Yeah, but still, no, you need the branding in there somewhere. I mean, don't overdo it. Don't get sponsored by a gambling company or a cigarette brand. Well, no, brand it. Don't just call it the 4-minute mile if you're getting more done during the 4 minutes than walking a mile. It's probably not walking anyway, is it? It's running. If you walk a 4-minute mile, that's not impressive because you obviously have very, very long legs. You're a very huge joint or something. You're taking huge strides. That's not an achievement. If you're just born with very long legs and you can take very long strides, no, that's just an accident of birth. Walking a 4-minute mile is far, far less impressive than running a 4-minute mile. So that's just something to bear in mind. If you're about to have plastic surgery or have had it. If you're listening to this while building a sandcastle or perhaps a snow castle. Do you build snow castles? Maybe you don't. Or maybe you call them something else to kid yourself into thinking it's an entirely different concept. Perhaps you build snow fortresses or igloos. Well, it's not really an igloo. It's a toy igloo. Just as when you build a doll's house, that's not a real house. When you build a snow fortress in the form of an igloo, that's not a real igloo. Your family isn't going to move into that. You're a child. You built a fake igloo. It's not a real igloo. It's never going to be your family home. Unless, of course, something terrible happens and you've been left to fend for yourself. All of your parents are dead and the authorities never find you and bring you to an orphanage and you're just left there to fend for yourself. And this all happens to happen in the depths of winter when you happen to have built a fake igloo. That's going to become your real home then, I suppose. That's the one instance. Your fantasies about building your own igloo home and being an Eskimo will kind of come to life. But you know that's all going to come crashing down at some point. especially in this country. Snow never lasts for more than a day or two in this country. The longest snow I can remember was in 1982. I was 6 years of age, and even then, we didn't build igloos. No, we might have built a snowman, I don't know. I do remember going out into the back garden and finding that the snow was coming right up to my knee. Either way, don't fool yourself. If you're a kid building a snowman and then you're building an igloo, for one thing, have you got the scale right? The standard snowman is quite a large thing. Kids tend to build snowmen quite big. It's as if they're building a bonfire. They build a big snowman. They probably build it at least 5 or 6 feet tall. And then it's taller when they put the hat on top and the pipe sticking out of its face, whatever they do. But then when you're finished with your snowman and it happens to be quite a longer than usual spell of snow, the cold snap is going on for a few days. Perhaps the next day you're still off school and you decide, oh, we'll build an igloo for the snowman to live in. Or you just think, we'll build an igloo, a fake igloo. You build an igloo and invariably it's not to the same scale as the snowman. Because if you were to build an igloo to the scale of that snowman, it would have to be something like at least 6 feet tall, wouldn't it? Well, maybe not quite that tall. It would have to be big enough to live in, though. That snowman isn't going to be able to get into that igloo. No. If you want us to believe that you can build a credible fake igloo, child, build the igloo around the snowman. You built the snowman yesterday. Now build the igloo around the snowman so that the snowman is inside it. I think you'll find, first of all, then you'll have to make sure the snowman is sitting down. You'll have to make a snow perch for the snowman to sit on. And you didn't think of that while you were building the snowman, no. We're going to see how good you are at adjusting a snowman. You're going to be able to treat it like a plasticine figure that you made for a stop motion animation. You're just going to bend it a bit now for the next step of it. You build a standing snowman and now you're going to bend it into a sitting position so you can build an igloo around it. Good luck with that. Good luck with that. And even when you do that, if you do succeed in building an igloo around that snowman, nobody's going to believe that you got that snowman into that igloo or that it's a credible entrance for the snowman. That's like getting a model of a ship and building a glass bottle around it by blowing hot, whatever you do to make a glass bottle. You manufacture a glass bottle around the existing ship. You get the equipment for whatever you do to blow glass. I think it's something to do with blowing and very intense heat. And I presume sand. Isn't glass made out of sand? I think it is. So presumably you get the sand, you light it on fire, you blow some air onto it from a straw using the hot air from your mouth. The same hot air that's been spouting all this nonsense about building a ship in a bottle and an igloo that a life-size snowman could credibly have gotten into without cheating. You're going to do that, are you? Oh, good luck with that. Wait a minute. I've seen documentaries about this on the television about the craft of crystal and glass making. I don't think I remember them ever having a bucket of sand that they start with. Isn't sand the raw material for glass? I think so. But no, they just show someone with what looks like molten lava, a ball of molten lava that they're shaping into the form of a crystal vase or a glass ship, whatever they're making. They don't show the sand. I don't think they're doing that from scratch. No, I think they're getting preformed, whatever the sandular equivalent of half-baked bread is. You know when you buy one of these half-baked bread rolls that you keep in their cupboard, it's half baked, and then when you want a fresh roll with your salad, you put it in the oven for 10 minutes and you have a fresh baked roll. Is there the equivalent of that with glass? I presume there is. They're not buying the sand, they're buying half formed glass, a bowl of it. It's like some sort of dough. It's like buying dough. And of course, nowadays, dough was considered an ingredient. You can have cookie dough ice cream, you can have cookie dough cookies. You can have just a bag of cookie dough that you snack on. Dough is an ingredient. Don't be eating dough. That's gross. I'm sure it tastes fine. It also tasted fine when you were 3 years of age and your mother was baking and she let you lick some of the dough off the spoon before she put it in the oven. But that doesn't mean it's food. No, you're not an animal. Eat some proper cooked dough. In other words, bread or however it's being baked. Anyway, you're a child, you're making this igloo that's supposedly going to be a home for this snowman. How would you feel? You were brought into existence through bad weather. If I know, I'm not flesh, I'm made of snow and ice. I'm made of all of the bad stuff that comes in winter and falls from the sky. That's what I'm made of. When I was a child, they used to tell you that kids were made of puppy dogs' tails and something. What was that poem? Did it say puppy dogs' tails and something else and something else? There was a nursery rhyme about all the lovely things their kids were made of. These same kids are making snowmen out of disgusting slush, filthy snow that's been sitting on the ground, probably full of dog shit. And that's their first impression of how a human being is made. No wonder they grew up despising us. They grew up despising older people. They grew up with this thought, oh, I made an adult once. It was disgusting. It melted after a couple of days and it was full of dog shit. And had rotten carrot in it. Now, admittedly, that was my fault. I put a carrot in it, and it turned out they don't keep very long. Although they keep a couple of days, because it's cold weather. Effectively, the outdoors is a fridge for a couple of days. Well, in this country, that goes away very, very, very quickly. You go back to depressing, mild, grey skies, mild temperatures, and just constant drizzle. So no, that's not going to be a fridge for a long time. You Americans probably just don't use a fridge at all during the winter. You just put everything outside the back door. It's probably great. It's absolutely great. I don't get to use my shed as a fridge much because it's not cold enough most of the time. But sometimes during winter, I've used it. A few months ago, we put our deceased, much loved elderly cat Jody in the garden shed for a night. Before we could bring her to the place with the furnace. And that was fine. And I think when our fridge broke last year, we put some stuff in there for the night. Ended up throwing most of that away though. We threw Jody away, but not in the bin. We brought her, as I say, to the proper, not incarceration place, not incarnation place. In whatever the thing beginning with I-N is. You know what I mean. Now you'll build a sandcastle or you'll build an igloo. Or you build a snowman, but you won't build a sandman. The kids don't build sandmen, as far as I know anyway. I've never seen it. You'll build a sandcastle, because that's relatively easy to make a structurally sound one. Although it usually only has to last for an hour or two, because you're visiting the beach for the day. It's not like you're going to come out the next morning and see if your sandcastle is still there or has it melted. No. We'd sit on the beach all day, we'd make a sandcastle, and then we'd take no responsibility for that sandcastle once we left. We'd stay there for a couple of hours, make sandcastles, have a picnic, and then off home back to where we came from and not see that place again, probably for at least a year. At least when children make snowmen in their back garden or in the common public green area that's temporarily white in their residential area, at least they come out the door the next day and they take note of whether the snowman is still there, how well it's lasted, has it disintegrated. When you make a sandcastle, you're the equivalent of a builder who just throws up some shit, takes the cash and runs, never to come back and look at it again. So I applaud the children somewhat for their snowmen in that respect. But still with your igloos, that's bullshit. Igloos are bullshit. If you're a child making a fake igloo, you're no better than if you have a doll's house. Although at least you made the igloo yourself. The doll's house is probably made by some craftsman or more likely in a factory where they make all the Barbie dolls. They go, I'm a Barbie doll in a Barbie world. Snapping plastic, it's fantastic. You can brush my hair. Where's my, not my harmonica for this one. I have a ukulele here. Hold on. I'm a Barbie girl in a Barbie world. Come on, Barbie, let's go party. Oh, 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 come on. There's two strings broken. There's two strings broken on this ukulele. That's useless now. I regret not having used that more before the strings got broken, which I think must have happened quite recently when I threw this across the room. Not to worry, you can't have everything. The point is, you have a doll's house. That's not made by the child. The child doesn't get to claim responsibility for having built that. or even furnish it because their parents bought all the furniture. At most, they take responsibility for the doll's bedtimes when it's dragged into or out of its bedroom and plunged into some kitchen somewhere or whatever they do. Whatever they do with these dolls' houses, absolutely, it's absolutely fine, I suppose. It's play. Children need their playtime, just like your cat does. Your cat has playtime. You wave a ball in front of it and make it believe that it's killed something, and that's very good for your cat. It tires itself out, and then it feels like it's done everything it was built to do by evolution. And then it'll cheerfully sit down, have something to eat, and go asleep, and start purring, and start dreaming about killing something. It lies on your bed and dreams about killing something. It dreams about eating the flesh off a dead dog from next door by tearing it apart with its teeth, going, oh, this is delicious. It's not really thinking about the taste when it says it's delicious. The experience of saying is delicious, the satisfaction it gets from fulfilling its evolutionary needs as a killer. That's what your cat does. As for what your children are doing with the sandcastle, I've no idea. Sandcastles are a parlor trick. You're just getting damp sand, and if that was dry sand, that wouldn't work. And that's why your child is making a sandcastle is never going to be working for a Waterford Crystal. Because until you Waterford Crystal, you don't get damp sand and set it on fire. No, you can't set damp sand on fire. It has to be completely dry so they can't sheet and use dampness to hold it all together. No, and it has to last longer than one day as well. So don't let your kids fool you with all that absolute tripe. It is nonsense. It really is. It really is nonsense. The whole business of being a child is nonsense, especially during the summer holidays and during snow days. Now, we had relatively few snow days as children, less than a handful of snow days in my entire school-going era. The last snow day I had, I was around 30 years of age. I wasn't in school anymore. I and my wife were commuting from South County Kildare to the centre of Dublin every day. One evening, I left work at 5 p.m. It started snowing. Snowing was starting to build up. Very sudden snow. We got in the car around 5:15, started driving, and got home at 1 a.m. Now, admittedly, we stopped at some disgusting fast food outlet in Talla for half an hour to take a break from the snow driving. My wife was driving. I was sitting there going, oh, Christ, we're stuck in traffic in snow. Car's probably going to stop working now. Do cars even work in snow? I don't know. I know if you drive a car through a flood that's quite deep, your car starts floating downhill and you don't know where it's going to go. You're probably going to flow into some river. And if that happens on your way from Dublin to South Kildare, it's going to end up back in Dublin city centre, because that's where the rivers around there all flow into. You'll flow back into Dublin city centre, which is where you started, and you may well end up out in the sea. Never ever drive through a very deep puddle in a flood. If the road is flooded, you don't go down there. You don't know where you're going to end up. No. If you're listening to this on your television, perhaps you're one of these sophisticates who puts on a podcast on your phone and then casts it to your television or casts it to another device that's connected to your television. Perhaps you've got an Apple TV or whatever the hell you use for that. I do know on the phone sometimes you press a button and then you see a thing that says cast and you say, cast this to another device. I don't want this. Send it somewhere else. My phone is in my pocket. I don't want this program in my pocket. That's too close. I want to cast it to a device that's in the corner of my sitting room or to a smart speaker or something. I want to send it somewhere else, slightly further away from me, but not too far away. Do people do this? Do they sit in their house listening to podcasts or loud music, perhaps, on their phone, but cast it to the speakers on their car that's sitting out in the street outside? Maybe they do that, because maybe they like the experience of listening to their favourite music on their car speakers while they're not in the car. I could understand why you could do that, in fairness, because sometimes you'd be passing a car and they'll be blasting out music The windows and doors will be closed, but they'll be blasting out music inside the car. You can hear thud, 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 and the beat of some music that's not to your taste. You do that all day, and at your weekend, you think, oh, I'm going to have that experience listening to music coming out of a car that I'm not sitting in, but it'll be music that I like. So I have my car out in the driveway, I'm sitting in the sitting room, I get the music up on my phone and I cast it to my car's speakers. Now I can see why there'd be an attraction to that. Just for a break, just on your weekend. Don't do it all the time, of course. For one thing, you'll annoy your neighbours. Would that not wear down your battery on your car? I think it would. I don't think you want to be doing that too much. No. I left the light on inside our car once and I ran the battery down so much that we ended up joining AA for a year just to get that fixed. Be careful about your car battery. Even if you got a petrol car, the stuff in your car runs on a battery that can run out. It's not like those hybrids. I know you all have hybrids now. We still have a thoroughbred car because we're not rich like you. We don't get to buy a new car every 6 months every time they invent a new kind of electricity. So no, we still have a thoroughbred petrol car. But the stuff on it runs off a battery. And having petrol in it doesn't guarantee that the battery will still work. No. So you can run it down easily just by leaving something on that uses up the battery. And then you end up having to call some sort of service to come and put electricity into your car for you. Either that or you push the car down the hill to the bottom of the hill and you say, oh, we've got it to the bottom of the hill now. That's great. It's great that we live on a hill because we can push our car to the bottom of the hill down to the main road. And now we just have to try and figure out where we can bring it to get it fixed. Because while there is a garage across the road at the bottom of that hill, I don't think it's a service garage. I think they just do fuel and have a shop that sells sandwiches and coffee and chicken rolls and sweets and stuff. I don't think they fix cars. I don't think you can get your car charged down there or get a new battery. No, I think you have a car wash there, possibly. That's not going to help you. So we have to bear that in mind. So when I drained the battery on our car accidentally, we joined the Automobile Association. They said, hello, can you help us? And they say, certainly, you just have to join our organization for a year. I can't remember what exactly they did. I think they probably just jump-started it. Is that a thing? I've only seen that done on medical dramas. I don't tend to watch motoring dramas. I just watch medical dramas. But they jump-start people sometimes. They say clear and they electrocute the dying person in the hope to bring them back to life. They go clear and everyone stands back and then they start pumping on their chest again, breaking their ribs, going, hello, you need to wake up now or it's going to be rather permanent. I'm pumping some electricity into you and I'm pressing against your ribs. So please wake up. I think we have had our car jump started by another motorist in the past who's on the same road. Hello, could you drive up in front of us and then you turn your car around so it's facing the wrong way and put the front of your car right up against us as if we've just collided, but don't quite collide. Just come close enough for our jump leads to stretch from your engine to our engine. Anyway, that's how cars work. To the best of my knowledge, I don't drive. I'm not able to drive, and even if I was able to drive, I wouldn't be allowed to. They don't let you drive if you can't see past the windscreen. No. If I could sit on the bonnet of the car out on the front lid, I could probably see a couple of feet in front of the car. In the old days, when you used to have horse and carts, if you had a horse and cart and you were being driven around inside one of those covered carts, there'd be a fella up on top in front who'd be controlling the ropes that steer the horse. That would be the equivalent of sitting on the front of the car. You can control a horse with ropes and straps. You just attach to the horse. Really to God, you can do the same with a car. I don't see why not. I also don't see why, though. When we went from horse and carts to cars, we quite rightly changed it so the driver wasn't sitting up front on the outside. We let the driver sit inside with the passengers at the front. The passengers would sit in the back and the driver would sit at the front, but the driver would be indoors. If you were employing someone to drive your horse and cart, you're probably a small business or you're a rich person who employs a driver to drive your horse. You'd rather have them inside, because if they're outdoors all the time while they're driving your horse and cart, they're at higher risk of getting sick all the time. They're going to be constantly getting sick, and then they're going to be sneezing all over everyone. They're making the horses sick as well, or the horses are making them sick. Because if you're outdoors driving a horse all day, those horses catch a cold, they pass it on to you. You get a cold, you pass it on to the horses. Every 5 minutes, you're all passing diseases on from one of you to the other. Oh, it's like when my wife was a primary school teacher. She'd go in the first day, beginning of term, first thing happened was that everyone gets a cold and everyone brings it home to their husband. It's exactly like that if you have a horse and cart. So they were right. When they brought out the motor car, they were right to move the driver indoors. It's safer. They didn't move the horses indoors. They just replaced the horses with an engine. So what we had was a horseless carriage. Now, if Henry Ford or whoever was coming up with all this stuff had said, I was thinking we'd have a horseless carriage. But how about if we have a carriageless horse? What would that be? Well, that would be a car still. But you'd be sitting on top of it. He'd have a saddle on top of this car thing. The car would be a small thing shaped like a horse with an engine inside it. You'd be perched up on top and no, even the passengers wouldn't get to sit indoors then. No, we're better to have a horseless carriage than a carriageless horse. I suppose it's just words, really. It's just words. So that's horses for you. And then you had cyclists. Now, cyclists back in the days of the horse and carriage, cyclists were considered very advanced. Not only was it a horseless carriage, it was a self-propelled carriage. You were the passenger and you were the horse and you were the engine. You were pedaling this thing, possibly on a penny farthing bicycle. That was one of those things where a huge, massive, massive, massive wheel and a little wheel in front, I think. Now, is that right? Have I got that right? I don't know. Do you see these penny farthing bicycles in photos? People used to drive these penny farthing bicycles. They had a massive wheel. You wonder how they stay up. It was almost as difficult as riding a unicycle. At least on a unicycle, you've got one wheel, you've got your pedals. Wait, does a unicycle, I don't know, sure. Does it have pedals? Kind of. It has pedals. They go around. They're attached to the wheel. There is a saddle. But there's nothing else. There's no handlebars. That's appalling. If you're going to go out on the unicycle, you're no better than the cyclist who goes around cycling hands-free and showing off like a child. So I remember as a child, you'd figure out one day that you could cycle hands-free, at least for about 3 seconds. I tried a couple of times. I was able to go hands-free for about 3 seconds in the right conditions. Why didn't? I wasn't reckless as a child. I kept my hands on the handlebars nearly all the time. I thought it was bad enough that I would have to take one hand off to make the proper hand signals as required in the rules of the road, because I used to obey the rules of the road as a child. I'd make hand signals. If I was turning right, I'd glance behind me, then I'd put out my right hand, take off the right handlebar, I'd put out my right hand, and then I'd move over to the right turning lane, and then keep looking behind me, and I'd keep my hand out until I was completing my turn, because I was a law-abiding child. That was dangerous. That's dangerous. You're taking your hand off the wheel. Surely they could have invented some sort of lighting mechanism. In fact, they did invent. They invented indicator lights, but they never put them on bicycles. If you have a law-abiding child like I was, your child is having to take his hand off the handlebars at the exact moment when he's going around a difficult 90-degree corner and cycle with one hand just to obey the law regarding hand signals. 100 years of cycling, no one has ever thought to put indicators on a bicycle. They don't care about your child. And you put your child in one of those things, you should be ashamed of yourself. Now, you can understand on a unicycle, they don't have indicators because you never know where you're going on a unicycle anyway. It's a mystery ride. You're getting on. You just hope to hell to not fall off. That's the best you can hope for. You don't know where you're going to end up. Hopefully, you're not doing that on the public road. You've got indicators on your car. You would never dream of taking your hand off the steering wheel and putting it out through the side window to make a right turn signal or a left turn signal. For one thing, you put your hand out like that, the first thing that's going to happen is that a car is going to hit it, because they don't care about your child's hand. The driver will go, oh, there's a hand, we better not drive into that. But then the passenger will go, it's okay, it's not one of our kids. People have very little respect for cyclists as it is. It's a cyclist and it's someone else's child. Fuck it. That's what they'll say. And then they'll just drive straight through the hand.
Into your head.
Once upon a time, there was a dog. A dog. A dog. A dog. A dog. A dog. A dog, etc. And this dog, he was driving home one day from a long day at the office. He was a fictional dog, obviously. He's one of those cartoon dogs who wears a collar and a necktie, but no other clothing. Perhaps a pair of glasses while he's working. It's a car made out of rocks. He's not in the same universe as the Flintstones, but he's in a Flintstones clone, the Flint Dogs or something. So the whole car is made of rock. It's got moving parts, but those are all made of rock too. There's no windscreen. There'd be no point making a windscreen out of rock. Well, I suppose if this Stone Age society is advanced enough to make a car that a dog can drive, then surely they can figure out glass. Glass is just sand. As we discussed elsewhere in this episode, glass is made out of sand. So if they can make a car out of rock, surely they can figure out how to manipulate sand. So it becomes a transparent screen that you put on the front of a car. Maybe they have. Maybe they know all about glass and they know how to make glass. It just hasn't occurred to them that that would be useful at the front of a car. I suppose there's that. But it's not going to protect you from much, a windscreen in that world. Because everything that flies through the air, anything that gets thrown through the air, including someone's hat, everything in that Flintstones world is made of rock. So anything that comes through your windscreen is made of rock, and a glass windscreen isn't going to stop that. It's just going to break it. So I suppose that's reasonable. That's interesting, though. You have this glass. Glass is made of sand, and a rock can just break sand. Sand is a broken rock. If you're a glass, you're made of sand. The sand is broken down rock. So why would a rock going through glass, which is made of broken down rock, why would that be a threat to it? Well, apparently it is. Anyway, this dog, he's on his way home from work, and then he gets home from work. It's a bit like the opening titles from The Sopranos, the television program. This gangster head honcho fella, this godfather type fella, except he lives in the suburbs. So the opening segment is him driving home to the suburbs, to his ordinary suburban house. The view from his front windscreen. The dog is a bit like him. He's driving home from his day at the office to his home in the suburbs. It's not really his home. It's his owner's home. He's driving home to his owner's home. So when he gets home and gets out of the car, he turns back into a normal dog. Because no normal human is going to allow their dog to come home like that in the car and say, oh, it's back from my day at the office. Where's my newspaper? I want my pipe and slippers. I'm going to sit down now and make myself comfortable and wait for you to make me a nice three-course dinner. No. That dog gets in the door and straight away he turns into a pet dog. He goes, woof, 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 I'm home. Oh, you're home too. That's great. I'm going to get all excited now and wag my tail and pant and get spit all over you because that's what you dog owners like. Is that what dogs were like in the Stone Age? I very much doubt it. Did they have dogs in the Stone Age? Why would you have dogs in the Stone Age? What would they do? Anyway, this dog, he stops at a red light and he thinks, oh, that light is red. I think that means this is the red light district. I want to get out of here. I don't want to be seen in here. This is a god-awful place. I don't want to be seen around here. I have a reputation to keep up. I'm very important. I'm a professional dog. I wear a collar and tie. And then when I get home, I wear a dog collar because I'm religious. No, wait a minute. Priests wear dog collars in this country. And dogs wear dog collars. Well, they're not the same thing. A priest collar and a dog collar, they're two different things. One is for holding a leash to you attached one end to the dog and the other end to a human hand. and you guide the dog. The dog collar on a priest is very different. For one thing, it's kind of under the collar of the shirt. You just see the front of it. It's like an iceberg. Most of it is under the shirt collar. So you just see the front of it. It's like an iceberg. You see 1 or 2 inches of this dog collar. I think priests' collars are called dog collars. Or wait, is that just something I heard someone say in a derogatory manner about them? They're not really called dog collars. Oh, maybe that's right. I'm confusing it. Well, in that case, I take that back. They're not called dog collars. But they are like icebergs. You just see the front couple of inches of the white collar that a priest wears, and then the rest is covered under the shirt. It's propping up the shirt collar. Makes it look nice and neat, I suppose. And you don't really need to see the whole thing, do you? Once you've seen part of a collar on a cleric, you've seen the rest. It's not like it's going to look any different around the rest of it, no. On a dog, it's different. You see the whole collar from any direction. You look at a dog from any direction, front, back, left, right, 60 degrees off to the hind left, 40 degrees off to the front right, any side of that, you should be able to see the dog's collar and instantly identify it as a dog. You say, oh, he's wearing a dog's collar. That means he's a dog. So it's very easy to identify a dog. And you might think you can identify a dog just by looking at it and seeing that it's a dog. Well, no. A lot of animals look very like a dog. They all have similar number of legs and paws. They all have one head, an oblong body, a tail at the back, a neck, a head kind of sticking out the front with a snout. A horse looks a bit like that. A cow looks a bit like that. A sheep looks a bit like that. A goat looks a bit like that. If you're living in a farming area, you're going to see lots of creatures that are pretty much the same shape as a dog. So don't be all smart about it. Just because you live in this city where the only animals you see are dogs. Anyway, I think we're approaching the end of today's episode of Into Your Head podcast. Goodbye. Now, don't turn off just yet. I said we're approaching the end. We're not at the end. We're not done here until I finish speaking. Do I have anything else to say? That's the issue. I suppose if I don't have anything to say, I'll just trail off. Please listen to the end of the closing theme tune, because someone put a lot of work into that closing theme tune. It's not just some nonsense that I chew together wherever you throw together theme tunes. No, that's a proper piece of music that was made by a band. So don't just go, oh, it's just some stupid music. No, the closing music for this show is absolutely fucking fantastic. So, in fact, listen to it now. Listen to it. I put it on right now and end. Here's the closing music. Go and listen to it. It's great.